Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to speak on the first day of the first theoretical talk this week, I guess. It's fantastic to be here. I mean, this is a really new topic for me, and I'm hoping to get a lot of feedback from you. And, so basically, I think Alexandra Tevez at some point mentioned last week that we're very heavy on the front end. So we discussed a lot of there are a lot of talks and discussions about how sensory information is in the brain, but we're kind of not really talking about behavior very much. So I decided to dedicate, to sacrifice myself to this topic. I mean, this is a new topic to me, and so this is basically about my work with collaborators at Cold Spring Harbor on animals' behavior. And, so this is like a review of collaborations. I've been working on it only for maybe a year and a half, so there are only three major projects. There's one about motivational salience, which I'm going to talk about today. So the experimental data that you'll see was collected by Marcos Stephenson-Jones and Bo Lee at Cold Spring Harbor. Marcos has now moved to University College. So the theory is done for this project is done by Sergey of computation, machine learning. It's done by Sergey Shuvayev, who is present here, and Tumitran. And then also there is another parallel project about foraging in mice, where the data is provided by Adam and Sarah. Sarah Staroste, Adam Kapetz at Cold Spring Harbor. And Sergey again is working with me on theory. And there is also, we're beginning to work on odorant-driven navigation in the context of reinforcement learning. And Batu is also somewhere. So he's working on that. And my collaborator at NYU also discussed with him. So this is the scope of project. I'll be mostly talking about project one. I think I have enough time for that. So I'll just, like, in the next few slides, I really have to apologize, but I'll review reinforcement learning so that I remember what I'm talking about. And basically, reinforcement learning is a branch of, and I really apologize for Christian Adelson, there's nothing new in the next maybe four slides. So reinforcement learning is a branch of machine learning that deals with basically agent and strategies of agent that is intended to optimize or maximize the overall level of reward. So the reward is a function of state, where the agent is. State is a function of time. And the cumulative future reward, which is being optimized, is called the value function. It's given by a sum of future rewards, depending on the state, with this discount factor, which is usually smaller than one. So there's a form of reinforcement learning which is called Q-learning, in which the sum of future rewards is given under the condition of that action A is taken at point T. Right. So then the Q function becomes dependent on the state and the action chosen at a given time, and it's given by the similar sum over the future time. And the sensible strategy, the simplest strategy that you can imagine, is to pick action at a given time that will maximize the Q function, right? So it will be just a maximum over A. So there is this Bellman equation, famous Bellman equation, where just based on recurrence, based on the definition of Q function as a sum of a future rewards with the discounting factor, you can also write the recurrence relationship, which is Q is a function of present reward plus maximum over the next time step. So that's the Bellman equation. In reality, however, I mean, if you evaluate Q function exactly, then it will become exact. In reality, you don't know the Q function exactly, so therefore, there's something called reward prediction error, which is one of the principal quantities, I guess, in reinforcement learning, which is given by the difference between the left-hand side of this equation and by the right-hand side of this equation and left-hand side of the equation, and it's usually non-zero. So if you don't know if this is non-zero, then you can actually update your estimate of the Q function by adding delta to it, so that when delta is zero, then you know that the algorithm converges. And of course, the remarkable thing is delta signal, it was actually observed in firing of dopaminergic neurons in the brain, in the ventral tegmental area. So these are the examples. So before learning, the reward was evoking the vigorous response in neurons in VTA, and then after learning, so this is classical conditioning where the sound precedes the reward. If the sound precedes the reward in the established task, then the firing is actually will be predictive of the future reward. And this firing of this neuron, actually, I mean, if you read this paper carefully, those are two different neurons. But so the firing of those two neurons reflects the what you would expect is the delta.
I'm just curious. In the experiments, the timing jumps. So right after the whipper reward, the unconditioned stimulus, to right after the conditioning stimulus. But does theory say anything as to whether it should be a smooth function of time rather than
a jump?
I
think it should be a smooth function of time.
It should be a smooth function. So this, in some sense, is against theory, experiment.
I'm not sure if this is like exactly against theory. I mean, I don't think it's possible to say that it's against theory, but there is probably a slight inconsistency.
But how you normalize this R or whatever? Because you know, is it just your choice or what? Because you know, how you ascribe certain numerical value to this?
I mean, I guess the animal will learn the level of reward. It doesn't normalize it. So, for example, this is like the next thing.
So it's arbitrary then.
It will learn the level of reward, right? And if you give it less reward, then it will actually this neuron will respond with inhibitory response. So it will actually respond to the emission of reward. So it learns some arbitrary level of reward that you give it. Yes.
So you are normalizing to result of experiment.
Animal normalizes, right? And roughly the firing rate of this neuron will be proportional to some power function, some power law, less than one of the level of reward.
So just point on, you say the theory predicts that the firing should progressively...
I think so.
Why does it do it?
I don't know. I mean, I think there is no exact solution, right? So there is a computer simulation. I don't think there is an exact solution for like temporal dynamics of how this bump shifts here. But if you look at computer simulations,
why do you say it predicts?
If you look at computer simulations, which you can like you can implement it in 15 minutes,
you'll see. So you will see how it slides.
So this is basically the first new slide. At the core of my talk is something called motivational salience. And the idea is that the reward is really dependent on the state of the animal. Like the value of reward is not an absolute, I guess, as you said. I mean, it depends on what you, if you are hungry or what you...
I'm a bit bothered by this. So you say it should be sharp but move, or it kind of should be like spread and then sharpen the others?
Well, I don't remember exactly, to be honest, because, I mean, I can, there is a script on my computer. I can show you how it behaves. But I think it like spreads a little bit and then moves slow. And then it emerges.
And then reshuffles.
You're talking about the model, not the data.
I'm asking about the model.
I don't remember.
Because the model is in discrete time. So.
Yeah, but learning is very slow too. So like
yeah, in discrete time you can have at time t it goes down, and at time t plus one it goes up. Something like this. Because the model does not have a detail.
Well, because learning rate is very slow in the model.
Yeah.
It really is time is not discrete. Like on the
scale. But within a trial, within.
I mean, the learning occurs over many trials.
Yeah. No, but within the temporal dynamics within a trial typically is not described in detail in these models.
Yes, it is. So the idea is that the reward is not actually absolute. So there are some internal parameters that determine how valuable reward is, and that internal parameter is called motivational salience. And the guy who coined the word is Kent Berridge at UMichigan. So he basically introduced this form of reward. And the idea is that, for example, if you are thirsty, then the value of water will be very important for you. If you are hungry, you probably will value food over water, and some other nutrients may be missing, so they may become change from aversive to attractive. So this is an example of it, which is from the paper of this guy. So So this is a response in of neurons in the area of basal ganglia called ventral pallidum, which is so this is a response in rats which were deprived of salt. So in this case, so this is the response to salt when the salt was depleted from the ration of the rat. The conditioning the CS, the sound which usually precedes salt, was evoking the same response in those neurons. I mean, these are not the dopaminergic neurons. These are neurons in the nucleus in basal ganglia, which fire vigorously to the conditioning stimulus, to the sound preceding salt, when the salt was depleted from the ration, when the diet of the rat was sodium balanced, then the same conditioning stimulus, the same sound, didn't evoke any response. In fact, salt is a bit slightly, as they write, is slightly aversive for the rat. So this is, he gives it as an example of something changing, but it's a common sense thing to consider reward being a function of an internal state. So then, I guess the one question that you can ask me is, what is the difference between state and this motivation factor, motivation vector? And I think the way I think about it is they operate on different time scales. If state changes after every action of the animal, we have potential to be changed. After every action of the animal, motivation is really something that changes very slowly. Yes?
And you think that the discount factor is also motivationally determined?
Well, not in the model. No, I'll assume that discount is fixed.
Discount is fixed. It's just the reward.
Yes. So then the Q function becomes also a function of three variables, right? So the question is whether animals can learn, or whether models, networks, can learn this function, right? So I understand that I will be not very welcomed by many people here, but I'll talk about artificial neural nets, and maybe your motivation towards neural nets will change after my talk. So this is it. Yes.
Why do you separate S and mu? Is it because mu is low dimensional, or
no? Mu actually is something. I assume that mu changes very slowly.
What's the time scale of it?
Yes, because like you become hungry. I mean, your actions are they lead to state changes at every step, whereas the motivation changes very slowly. I'm assuming. I mean, there are different formulations. Like in one of the examples that I'm going to describe, motivation will be an explicit function of time, not a function of state.
Okay.
So, and another examples, I mean, I guess the one thing which goes through all those examples is that motivation is a slow function of time.
And that separates them in the maths that you're going to show?
Yes.
Okay. In real life, that's not so bad.
I'm not sure. Like, whether we can separate,
it's
I don't know what happens.
Immediately.
I hope you accept my thinking of motivation.
So in reinforcement literature, the notion of state S is a bit confusing. I always thought it's about some kind of internal state, but it's not, right? So it could be about just external stimulus. It could be about at what time you are in the delay period. That's S. So each time step, you have to change S.
Yes.
So that certainly is different from the motivational kind of.
I mean, I guess a common thing which goes through that literature is that action leads to the state, changes state, whereas it's not necessarily the case for motivation.
So in the reinforcement learning literature, for example, in video games like Beating Go or something, they have a reward function, but it's an extremely complicated function. And I'm just curious, so what you're basically, I'm curious about the motivation, because if I understand correctly, you're sort of exposing a complicated reward function by this thing called motivation. I'm just curious for the motivation of that.
What is my motivation of that?
Yeah, the motivation of the motivation.
I think, like, there are a lot of recurrent things that happen in different types of literature, including reinforcement learning and psychology and neuroscience. And I'm just trying to kind of connect the dots. That's my motivation. I mean, there may be, I mean, things that are discovered in different fields, and the same things are recurring, and I'm talking about it because I'm interested in understanding what the connection are.
Mathematically, can you think of the motivation as just part of S?
I mean, it's very slow.
But S could be changing slowly. It could have multiple time scales in the state statistics.
I mean, mathematically, in the first example that I'm going to describe, motivation is just explicit function of time, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are different.
But time in the state.
No, just I mean, if you have a cue for a reward is a function of state, which is, for example, your position, and motivation is a function of time.
Yeah, but I'm saying if you augment the state by adding an explicit clock in the state, then motivation would be part of the external state too.
Maybe.
And that may have some mathematical advantages because then you can use all of the existing reinforcement learning framework to solve the same problems if you know how the motivation changes.
Maybe, yes.
So what about temporal discounting? This also sounds like a bit of reduction in motivation with time, right?
Discounting is
the same thing.
Yeah.
As time goes
discounting
by,
may be considered a form of motivation. I think, like, mathematically, it's formulated a bit different from.
Yeah, but in essence, it's a bit similar. Or maybe it's identical.
It's not identical, but maybe qualitatively the effects may be similar. But I can imagine, for example, that you would have increasing motivation as you consume more food, right? So then the discount becomes positive, you know.
The discounting just gives you a planning window that you have to think over. The motivation could go on forever.
So, I appreciate the discussion. So, I'm thinking of basically implementing it in a neural net and see how it's going to work. So, I mean, this is like a common framework. So, I'm going to do. I mean, I'll show you next over the next.
This is given to you. The motivation as a function of time is given to you.
That's what I'm trying to describe.
Okay.
So the neural net, there will be a neural net which will be receiving two types of information. It will be receiving information about state and motivation, right? So it will receive motivational information. And then the goal of the network is to compute the Q functions as a function of action. And then the network, I will use a very simplistic approach. I will use backpropagation to train the network. So I'm not going to use anything biologically realistic. I'm just hoping that I'll be able to reconstruct the structure of the network. So the network will compute the Q function, then it will also receive reward. I'll compute delta reward prediction error, and I'm going to feed it back through the action that was taken into the network, and I'm going to correct the weights. So that's my strategy that will go through like three chunks of my talk. So the question is if you can learn the relationship between the reward and motivation. So the first example will be Four Rooms. I think it was motivated by this movie by Quentin Tarantino. So there are four, it's an apartment. There are four rooms. One of them is a bar. If you're thirsty, you go there. Another one is a kitchen. Then there is a living room where you can watch television. And then there's also your cabinet where you work, you study. So then the idea is that there is an agent. Agent can have execute five actions up to four movements, and then can also stay in place. So the reward that the agent receives is just the scalar product of the motivation. Each room has its own motivation, right? And then the reward as a function of position, actually, at point T will be the sum of those four basis functions and four motivations. So then the motivation will increase at every time step by one in every room. Right, so this is just the sequence. Like, for example, if agent is in this room, its motivation is roughly unchanging, but the hunger will grow as a function of time linearly, and then the desire to do some work will also grow.
But the motivation could change during the process, right?
Huh?
Motivation also could change, say, thirst or hunger, yeah?
It does change,
yeah,
right? So it goes up,
yeah.
Right? So if you don't eat, you become hungrier. That's the idea.
So it's not slow. Didn't you say it should be slow now?
Well, it's a linear function. It doesn't have any time scale, right? So,
okay, so it's not slow.
Infinite time scale. Time scale of linear function is infinite, so it's very slow.
Yes.
So. So this is to illustrate the same thing. So, linear function. Okay. So. So the motivation is a zigzag, right? So if, for example, here I'm visiting this fourth room, it will set to zero, and then it will slowly increase, right? And then it will drop when I revisit the room.
That was a workaround. It means you publish every time it drops.
Excuse me?
That was a workaround, right? So that means you publish the paper. When
yeah.
It drops.
Well, you went there, you kind of got discouraged, and then you left. But the memory still lingers on. So. So what are the possible strategies? So this is the simplest strategy, one room binge. And they just sit in one room and do nothing, and move nowhere, right? So then your reward will be like this. Well, motivation to go to other rooms will increase slowly, but since you don't go there, you don't care, right? So you will, the way we set up is that the reward you receive will be 0, 1, 0, 1. So you will have, when you consume this one reward here, your motivation will reset to 0, the next time step it will increase to 1, and then you will again consume it, and so on. So the average reward that you will receive will be 1/2. So then there is a better strategy, which is called a two-room binge, when you actually hop from one room to another. So you sit, you're in the doorway between the bar and the kitchen. You run from one room to another, right? So then. Obviously, the reward that you will receive will be always driven by novelty of the new stimulus, and it will be always one. So the average reward will be one. And then finally, the interesting strategy is when you go circles in this apartment, and in this case, you can compute what the average reward is. It's kind of simple, so. Because it's all periodic, I can just consider one room, right? So there, the reentrance of this room occurs nine steps, right? So every time I enter the room, I will receive 9, because the length of this path is 9. I'll receive 9, then I receive 0, and then I receive 1. So in passing the room, I'll receive the total reward that I receive will be 10. So the average reward will be 10 divided by 3, because that's how many steps it takes to pass the room, so it will be 3.3. So obviously, migration strategy wins to the binges. So we decided to make it a little bit more complicated, so we capped the motivation by some threshold. So I'm going to consider strategy as a function of threshold. And then what we did, we took a neural net, it's a three-layer feed-forward net that is of the type that I described, so it receives 40 inputs, 40-dimensional inputs, so the binary vector that describes what cell of it's a 36 by 6 apartment, right? So it's a 36-dimensional state vector and 4-dimensional real valued or integer valued, doesn't matter really. Spoiling the surprise. So the motivational vector is 4-dimensional, and then basically, it has to compute the Q function, the future reward for 5 possible moves.
And the rooms are identical. The rooms are identical.
I mean, they're from all points of view, they're identical, yes. So this is what you get. This is the result of this neural network trained. So each of the blue points is a separately trained network. So this is average reward as a function of this cap at which you cap the motivation, right? So obviously, if you kill motivation at 1, then the best strategy will be two-room binge, jumping from one room to another, because then migrating, you don't really win anything. So that's what indeed it finds. It finds this is one-room binge. And then there is a migration. It also finds a solution which goes to those 10/3, which is the migration strategy. But it also finds additional strategy, which was a surprise to us, which was the delayed Turun Bridge. I'm going to show it to you. So this is the result of the strategy, if I can show it. Watch this. It doesn't want me to show it. This is funny. So this is the one when it jumps between two rooms. I mean, this is really behavior of the network. So this is another one is the, I should stop it. Is the new strategy which it found. Which is when it jumps to another room and then it stays there and it waits when motivation grows to in the previous room. So that's basically an intermediate strategy which is stuck between. And finally, that's the migration, example of migration strategy you can see here. Successfully finds. So basically, networks can learn simple behaviors in a case when rewards are really very variable and change in functional time. That's the conclusion I would like to make. Another thing, interesting thing, you can look at the response fields of the individual neurons in different layers, and you'll see that they indeed form something like place fields. And the neurons in the last layer, their place fields are very narrow, and they correspond to individual more correspond to individual points in the array. Then another example of motivation is the transport network. So imagine that you have a graph, it's a planar graph, and then you have an agent that is the goal of the agent.
And sorry, Alex, you mentioned the place fields. Do you find units that have multiple place fields, like equivalent places of the four rooms?
These are all of them. I mean, this is like a two-room unit. Yes, there are multiple. Okay. There's some of them which have multiple, like disconnected place fields. Yes.
Thank you.
So the transport network, where there is an agent, and it's supposed to collect reward in two cities. Yes.
Those place fields, you extracted them as a function of space, but it's not entirely clear in my mind how you go from a network to these representations. But what happened to the motivation variable in this?
In where? When we constructed this?
Yeah.
So the way we did it, I'm sorry for being coarse about it, which is basically let the network run randomly. So the policy was not the one which was guided by the network. It was just basically randomly exploring. It was trained to perfection, but it was just randomly exploring the rooms. And then as it was going through, we measured the firing of different units, and that's what you see here. Like it's averaged over random walk. So transport network is, so the agent is supposed to find the shortest path to collect two rewards in two different points. So in this case, motivation is basically, it describes where in the network the reward is. So for example, in this case, the city number 4 and number 5 has a reward, and therefore there will be ones there. And as the agent finds reward in city number 5, the motivation at that point is extinguished. So the only thing which it will have is the motivation to go to city number 4. And as it will find reward at city number 4, it will extinguish that reward, and it will lose completely the motivation. Motivation will be 0. Right. So that's it. So the question is if we can learn. Again, there is a simple two-layer feedforward network that will be doing it. And the bottom line is that it can learn it. So here you can see the learning process. Again, when it solves the problem, it doesn't really think. It doesn't solve the problem, right? It just basically solves it automatically. With motivation vector, it knows which cities to go to on the next time step. So essentially, the topology of the network is embedded inside the topology of the transport network is embedded inside of that network. So what you can see is that eventually after 5,000 iterations, training epochs, it will, with random networks, it will approach the shortest path, which is found by just some greedy algorithm. There's some examples of learning. I'm not sure if you care about it, but I think it's very core. So here, the agent starts. So this is basically the same transport network, and the targets are in the same positions here. And as the learning progresses, it will go from a large number of steps and like cycling around the network, pseudo-randomly, to basically perfect performance. So the third example that I was going to consider is a much simpler example, but will actually involve some experimental data. So this is a classical conditioning. I'll try to introduce the task very slowly. So the classical conditioning, there are basically six types of pairs between conditioning stimulus and unconditioned stimulus. I'll take some time to explain it. So there are two types of punishment: strong punishment, which was just air puff in the face of the mouse, and weak air puff, and then no air puff. There were specific sounds which were preceding those three types of unconditioned stimulus. And there was also three types of positive rewards. So there's a strong water reward with its own conditioning stimulus. There is a weak water reward with its own conditioning stimulus. And there is no water reward with its own conditioning stimulus. So, and the reason why this is different from this, although it may seem kind of the same, is that they were presented in different blocks. So all the negative rewards were blocked within about 20 trials. And all the positive rewards were blocked within the same block of trials. So when the animal was within the negative block, it was feeling very depressed, it was demotivated. Whereas when it was within the rewarded block of trials, it was motivated by the conditioning stimuli. Right? So that introduces this motivational variable, how much the animal is enjoying the trials. Okay? And then they recorded from neurons in ventral pallidum, which was the area which is thought of basal ganglia, which I mentioned, is involved in motivation. So there are multiple reasons why people think that it's an important area for motivation. I guess one of the most important reasons is that the neurons there, there are two types of neurons, the excitatory and inhibitory neurons, and they both show elevated firing after presentation of CS. So they actually show some reward prediction signal, as opposed to reward prediction error signal. So they have sustained responses during after CS, which is kind of one of the unique features for this type of neurons. So what they find, these are tetrode recordings. What they find is that they find two types of neurons. So they find neurons which are tuned to negative rewards, to punishment. So they show elevated firing rate to punishment. So this is the same neuron here. And then they find another type of neuron which show elevated firing rate to water reward. So there are two opposite types of neurons. And the amount of change in firing is graded in the dependence on the amount of reward. So this is basically two neurons which are shown here. They have about recordings from about 150 neurons in three different mice. So another interesting thing is that these neurons actually show delayed activity. Like here, there is a delay between CS and US of about half a second. So during that time, the neuron continues firing on. I mean, and this is like a common feature which is observed in the firing of VP neurons, including in monkey. And similarly, this neuron shows a change, but now it's suppression, sustained suppression and firing. Another thing is that they also show dependence on the their like overall firing rate shows dependence on the type of block that they're in. Like, for example, if you are in the punishment block, the spontaneous firing rate will be different from the reward block. Like this neuron, for example, spontaneous firing rate for this neuron is about 15 hertz in the punishment block, and in the reward block it will be lower, and vice versa. So the two important features that I want to highlight here are that there is a delayed activity and there is also dependence on the motivation, on what we think of the motivation is. This is the overview of all firing rates of all neurons, 149 neurons, to six different conditions. So this is like strong punishment, weak punishment, no punishment, strong reward, weak reward, no reward. And, I'm sorry about it. So this coordinate is time. So there are six different conditions, and what you see here are six periods of time within the trial, which each trial is about 6 seconds. And the neurons are actually clustered by some clustering algorithm into those negative, sensitive neurons. So these are punishment-sensitive neurons. As you can see, they show a higher firing rate to punishment than to reward. And these are reward-sensitive neurons. They show higher firing rate to reward than to punishment. And these are some mixed groups of neurons, which cannot be clustered. Yes.
So the water reward during the negative blocks, were they occasional trials? Or?
There is no water reward during negative.
So I don't understand the top right hand corner, there's a cell during the negative block during the water report. Am I misreading the figure?
I think these are different cells. So the same cell was recorded in six different conditions.
You're grouping negative positive according to whether they respond more strongly to...
Exactly, yes. Okay. So this is just a result of clustering.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I thought it was referring to the experimental structure.
Another thing which we know is that they also optogenetically determine the type of those neurons. So the ones which are negative are actually glute excitatory, and these are inhibitory neurons. So they know this piece of information. So paradoxically, the ones which are responding to punishment are elevation.
That's a perfect cell-type functional mapping.
Huh?
That's a perfect cell-type functional mapping.
Every
negative neuron is...
It's not really perfect, but like for the ones that they can determine, yes. Also the clustering or identification, functional identification is not perfect. Because it's a clustering.
You're making it sound pretty strong.
Well, it's not 100%.
I get it. It sounds like it's 90%.
Yes.
Okay. Strong.
It actually makes sense because VP has a projection to habenula. Habenula has projection to some nucleus which contains inhibitory neurons that then go to VTA. So there is a sign inversion before you go to dopaminergic neurons. Again, these are not dopaminergic neurons, but there is a, I think it's called rostramedial tegmental nucleus, which has inhibitory neurons, which actually inverts the sign, so therefore the excitation by punishment changes into suppression by punishment. So by looking at this, since there is a delayed activity, as I mentioned, so we decided that the circuit must look like a conventional short-term memory circuit. So the idea was that what maintains, and there are two opposing groups of neurons, the idea was there are two, so this is the proposed circuit in VP, right, that will maintain delayed activity between CS and US. The idea is that there are two groups of neurons, the glutamatergic neurons which are aversion sensitive and which are the negative, the aversion sensitive and the reward sensitive, the punishment sensitive and the reward sensitive neurons, they inhibit each other. And while inhibiting each other, they will have to, they will form a positive feedback loop, right? So there is GABAergic neurons will suppress glutamatergic neurons, and they, but I have to hypothesize that there is another group of neurons that will inhibit GABAergic neurons, right? And then there will be a positive feedback loop because two minuses will give me a plus. And this is similar to the proposals for short-term memory networks, which were developed in, for example, neural integrator and many, many other models. So I'm just showing here like what the condition is, like product of those three weights have to be one so that it will be perfectly balanced and it will remember the state. But we thought that, I mean, now since we have a hypothesis for how the function, how the circuit operates, we decided to see whether we can direct, we know the answer, kind of. Can we derive it? Can we derive it using machine learning methods? Right. So to this end, we trained the recurrent network, which will the goal of which is to compute the Q function, or the value function. It's a function of time, and like the, using the conventional protocol by providing it the delta. In which case, in this case, motivation will be just plus and minus one, depending on which block you are in. And the input will be the CS, the sound that you receive, the input that you receive in terms of sound. And I mean, obviously, you can train a recurrent net using backpropagation by just expanding them in time, right? So that's it, which was mentioned. So and these are the results. So again, I'll slowly walk you through this. Although, I mean, the results are mostly here. So this is what you see is the input into the network. So these are six conditions which I described: strong punishment, weak punishment, and so on. So this corresponds to negative motivation. So this is like a block of trials where the motivation was negative, and it's marked by here. So this is the input into the network. It knows that it's within the negative motivation block of trials. And this is the positive motivation, and this is these are the different sounds that it receives, which corresponds to which warn it of, for example, coming strong negative air puff. And this is warn about weak air puff, and this is warns it of nothing, really. So there will be no air puff. And this is the actual punishment, or this is the actual reward that it receives. So, and this is what you see here is the behavior of the network. So this is what it thinks the level of reward will be until the end of the trial, and this is the error signal. So some of it is actually pretty intelligent. Like for example, if it knows that it's within the negative block of trials, but it receives information at this point that there will be no punishment, it actually predicts that there will be no punishment. So as soon as it receives that there is no CS here, it will have no. It will predict that there will be no punishment. Whereas if it receives negative, strongly negative CS, it starts from some overall very depressed state here. So the expectation is very low about the future reward. But as soon as it receives very strongly negative CS, it downgrades its rating of the trial. It thinks that it's going to receive very bad. It's in a very bad situation until it actually receives the air puff, and then it will reset to zero. So the behavior of the network is actually pretty meaningful. But the most amazing part is that we indeed find two types of neurons, which we can cluster by the same algorithm, which are opposing. And you can look at the network between them. So here they're put kind of in a space. You can see that indeed there is this structure where kind of neural integrator type of structure, or linear attractor type of structure, where the neurons of the same type, they will excite each other and they will inhibit the opposing type. So it actually discovers what we hypothesized theoretically. The only thing which is missing here is the Dale rule, of course, right? So the same neuron has to be both excitatory and inhibitory, right? So it has to have an excitatory loop with itself and or within their own group, but it also has to inhibit the opposing group. So we didn't work out, we didn't install the Dale rule here in this network. But these are the examples of negative and positive neurons. And there are also some mixed types of neurons which change their responsiveness. The next thing which we did is we tried to train recurrent neural net, but now, question?
Yeah, the blocks, the positive and negative blocks, were they predictable or is it probabilistic?
No, it's like one block.
It's a fixed.
Like fixed block of 20 trials.
Okay, so when so it starts in principle, they should know, you should see a clock in there. If it's solving this optimally, you would count down from 20 and then it would know it's going to go into the positive case. Did you see anything like that?
You mean in training, when I trained my network?
Yeah.
The artificial neural network, it was interleaved. They were randomly interleaved.
But they were randomly interleaved.
Right, in artificial case. Because I have the freedom of supplying it with a dependent variable, which is motivation, which is here, right? So I'm just telling it what block of trial it's in.
Okay, you just tell it.
Right. And I think motivation for that was that there is no biases in the way how the network is trained, so it's randomized. But in reality, they were all like bundled up. So you can also do this, what was described, I think, question number two by Haim during the discussion of deep networks. Can we learn something by training a deep network to replicate neuronal firing? And I think, basically, I don't know, but this is the effort to do it. So now we have a recurrent net, which we're going to train by backpropagation through time to replicate so that the response vector, 149-dimensional response vector of this network, matches the observed responses of neurons, right? And the goal is to reconstruct the connectivity. So we did that, and I mean, you can see this is the observed responses, these are the predicted responses, and there is some degree of correlation between observed and predicted. So this is the example of neuron that has I think this has a negative tuning and has, unfortunately, the. So the idea is that the dotted, the solid line there are the predicted responses. You can indeed see that the responses of neurons generated by this recurrent net, they have the persistent feature which is observed in real responses. So, and you can also look at the network. So this is like basically the strongest weights in this network that that I singled out. So basically, it's not the entire network. And the entire network is filled mostly with zeros or something that you cannot see. And again, you can see that there's a block of excitation and there is a block of excitation between two types of neurons. Same neurons are connected by excitatory connections and different neurons of different types are connected by inhibitory connections. So it replicates this predicted structure. And there is no, I mean, we didn't install the Dale's rule. So this is kind of all very exciting, I think, like because the prediction is not so bad. Unfortunately, what is not very exciting is that the fact that it doesn't generalize very well. So if I remove the entire condition, for example, and I ask if the network can regenerate this condition, like for example, weak punishment, then, so this is shown here. Then the, I'm sorry, I apologize for this, but the R value, I mean, there is a non-zero correlation, and it's statistically very significant, but it's about 0.35. So if it doesn't really generalize as well as it extrapolates, or as it interpolates. So that is somewhat discouraging. Maybe we need to use some other tricks, which we haven't used. I mean, there's potential that we'll use tricks which are like wave decay and others that will help us to make it more accurate. So
why would you think that it would generalize to that case? I mean, is there some model bias that suggests that it would have that right structure in the network?
I mean, it's really like intermediate reward, so it's something between high reward and no reward. So my thinking was that it would be capable to generalize, but it generalizes very weakly. So also you can train it to, you introduce a Dale's rule by when you train, basically you don't go below zero for some weight, so you don't go above zero for inhibitory neurons. And so this is the type of network that you get. You can also understand it from mean field point of view, but I'm not going to waste your time with it. So this is really basically the next two slides. I'll try to explain why I think this is very exciting, and why I think that this is also very daunting to some degree. So what I described to you is that there is this reward function which is computed somewhere in the network, which is dependent on additional variable, which is motivation. And this additional variable was provided really by somebody, by some external mechanism, right? Which, for my artificial nets, I was just like giving it to them as an input vector. And then you maximize, you find the optimal action by maximizing this over possible actions, and then you change the state. It's possible that this motivation is also provided by some other network, right? So it could be that there is another network which operates not with states, but with motivations. And the actions of that network is changing motivation from one position to another. And potentially this level of hierarchy can go higher. And I think motivation is really one of the ways how hierarchical reinforcement learning can enter neuroscience.
Can you give us some intuition as to these two levels of motivation?
I tried to do it here. I mean, this is like Facebook Physics Institute. So I cooked up some examples. So this is like a top-level network. This is Alex trying to live through one day at KITP. So I need to do something. So basically, motivation is like a toolbox that you open. It doesn't really describe you what actions you are supposed to use, but it tells you like what groups of actions you can take. Like I like to do something. I want to solve a math problem. So then I pick a math problem, and then there are several ways how I can solve it. Like I can give it to grad student. I can use some other methods. Right. So, and each of those methods is not a single action. It's a large group of actions. Right. So I can bias. I can pass along to the lower level network, which will then implement like the physical solving of this equation and like movement of my, pencil and stuff like that. Right. So this is the way how the solving the problem can be broken down into smaller pieces. Right. And so the reason why I think it's exciting is because potentially, you can basically analyze behavior on different time scales, and you can find networks that manipulate behavior on different time scales, and implement strategy rather than individual actions. But also, it's daunting because, I mean, it's kind of easy for me to hypothesize. Now, it's easy to anthropomorphize, right? But it's possible that those motivation vectors that are passed along there exist on an abstract level, so it's difficult even to formulate what they are. So it will be even more difficult to understand what they, I mean, to study, to prove that this is what they are, right, really in the brain.
On that point, is there something about state dependence involving motivation that's different from any other kind of state dependence which you wouldn't use the term motivation to describe?
I don't understand the question, sorry.
What does it mean to say that the state dependence of the reward function is motivation?
It's not a state dependence of
maybe I misunderstood.
It's motivation is a slowly variable input into reward function. So reward, like hunger, right, grows with time, or it's extinguished with time.
So I call that state dependent.
I think it's not state. I think state is more like short range. It changes every moment, whereas motivation changes slowly. That's.
So I mean, I don't know if I would agree with that. You use state a lot for slowly varying things. Like if you're doing foraging, you have reward availability, and that might change slowly. The reward rate itself might change slowly when the reward itself is changing quickly. And you see, you can have a multitude of different timescales in the external state as well as the internal state.
Right.
So I don't know if the slowness is something that defines motivation per se.
Well, motivation is an internal variable. It's not really like the availability of reward. Right?
So there are.
I guess like I'm trying to describe more constructively, like a mechanism how you can build a hierarchy of behaviors using motivation when there is a different Q functions, which are computed by different levels of this hierarchy, and the input of the Q function here on this level hierarchy is provided by the top level network.
So I guess my question is, motivational state is a thing. Hunger is exactly an example of some state.
Right. So for this network, it's a state. Yes.
And I'm trying to, while you presented a more mathematical, as you just said, there's nothing about motivation that's needed to describe a hierarchical solution to a problem as being described mathematically. So what I'm trying to understand is what role motivation, what is motivation? Is it something that could be affected by something else in a certain way? How should I think about it as motivation as opposed to any other state or input? Why use the word motivation as opposed to attention?
It's a good question. I mean, it may be like attention is a form of motivation. I don't know. I mean,
I get it. It is, but
or to push along the same direction, but from a as a proposal or a suggestion, one might imagine that the reward function is like Alex lives his best day, and then these sub goals or motivations would to learn them as part of the neural network reverse engineering would be very much in keeping with the methodology.
I'm guessing that that's what the case of the three cases that they present is that actually learns the relationship between the reward and motivation vector. Like the original idea of how motivation was like incentive salience was introduced in psychology is that it's wanting the stimulus. It's not your internal, before you actually consume the stimulus, what is the your internal desire to consume the stimulus? So that's how it was formalized. I mean, I understand that the distinction between state and motivation is vague because I define it as there's different time scales. And as time scales are not, is not a discrete quantity, of course, it can be, it may defy mathematical definition. But that's why I'm presenting this so we can discuss it. So the final thing I want to just basically mention to you that hierarchical reinforcement learning has about 20 year history, maybe more. In computer science, and one of the most brilliant examples of it is this hierarchical RL, which is called pseudo reinforcement learning, pseudo networks, which were introduced by Peter Diane and Hinton. So the idea is that there, so this is not a network, it's pre-network reinforcement learning where the agent is supposed to find something in this 8x8 world with a wall in it. And so the world is really 64 cells, but like different cells are controlled by top-level managers. Like this particular area is controlled by a top-level manager, and the four top-level, second-level managers are controlled by a single manager on the first level, and there is like one big manager. So this therefore they're called feudal networks, because this is like a king, this would be like a prince, and so on. So, I mean, these are very powerful networks because, I mean, the idea is that they can plan behavior, they can plan macroscopic behavior, such as this manager, for example, will think that the agent should be moved to another cell and execute this plan, and this is something that is very difficult to for a network to implement, for a network that controls really each individual, or for an agent that is controlled by short-range policy. So it has this macroscopic capability to implement behavior which is macroscopic. So we just take this this agent and move it to the other side of the field, and so on. So therefore, I mean, as they show, they train, although initially they train very slowly, but then eventually they catch up and they train faster as than the usual Q networks. Then there is another hierarchical reinforcement learning example, which is called options framework, which is extremely interesting. I don't really have time to talk about it, but the idea is that again there are four rooms. I think it's called rooms example, and the idea is that in this framework, instead of individual actions, an agent can perform like long scale behaviors, such as it can pass the room. So in this case, like for example, this would be, there will be four actions, going from one hallway to another, or going from this hallway to this hallway, going through actually eight actions, going between hallways. And it turns out that it can learn very fast. It can learn to find this target in this particular doorway within a few steps, right? And even if, just because it has those long-range macroscopic behaviors, it can pass through basically several levels of redundant steps and implement those long-range behaviors and then reach target much more efficiently than a network. In this case, this is a network that controls agent. Well, sorry, this is not a network. I'm confusing it. This is just a simple reinforcement learning agent that is controlled by policy, which operates with individual actions going up, down, left, right. I'm hoping I made it clear. At least if I didn't, I may have motivated you to read this paper because I think it's very influential. It's become a part of like some standard packages for reinforcement learning. So I understand the time between you and the cookies. So this is what I described to you. So I tried to derive ab initio some networks which operate with motivation, and they display some interesting behaviors, including behaviors that are similar to the ones which are displayed by animals. And then motivation may be one of the ways how hierarchical reinforcement learning can enter neuroscience. Or maybe at least we'll start talking about it in this context. And then the scary part is that if there is indeed hierarchical reinforcement learning that's implemented in the brain, then it would be extremely difficult to understand because motivations on top levels of hierarchy may be very abstract. And it will be very difficult to access those motivations experimentally. Thanks very much.
So the last point seems odd to me that if they become more abstract, they're more difficult to understand. Because I thought if they become more abstract, there are fewer of them. They take fewer values or in a smaller space. There's more kind of.
I mean, it will be difficult to anthropomorphize. And therefore, it will be difficult to design experiment that will test, like whether this particular variable is the one which is, you know, controlling behavior of one network. That's what I mean.
Because in your example, Alex goes to work and wants to do something.
Basically, you don't know what is the goal that the network is trying to achieve. Looking at some manager in this hierarchy on an intermediate level, and you don't know what drives this manager. And so the input-output relationship to this manager, it's very difficult to understand unless it has some meaning to you as experimentalist. I think it's a challenging problem.
How do you think this relates to information to goal?
Information what?
Information to goal quantity. It's like the cost of control, the expected cost of control. And you know, there are some arguments that the reward function can be arbitrary, but ideally it should correspond to this information to goal function.
I know it costs to go. What is information?
Yeah,
is it like rephrasing it in terms of the KL distance or something?
Yeah, it's Tadek Tishko's monitor that he introduced just the cost to go, there is information to go, the expected cost of control that you expect to incur based on the current policy. And I thought that suppose in the ideal case, this information to go is supposed to correspond to the reward function. But the reward function can be internal to the organ, it can be arbitrary.
I mean, it's difficult for me to speculate. I think like you can have like an assumption or hypothesis for what reward is, but ultimately it has to be determined, right? So it doesn't have to comply with any kind of mathematical formalism. I mean, because the constraints under which animal.
The question is, the reward is like your motivation function is internal, right? It can be anything in principle, but some motivation functions will be better than others.
Yeah. Yes, but it's ultimately decided by something, by some constraints, like by physical constraints, such as, for example, the animal has to eat, has to drink, has to consume certain nutrients, right?
Yes.
So how do you derive it from, like, general principles? That I don't understand. I mean, you can hypothesize, and of course you're welcome to hypothesize, but ultimately the constraints they determine will be rewarded.
Well, I guess I don't fully understand it, but I thought, and that's why I'm raising it in discussion, but I thought that, you know, motivation function can be arbitrary, but the reward that the agent will get will depend on the motivation function that they follow. So one can compute or optimize both with respect to motivation policy, motivation part of the policy. And I thought that there is a derivation that ideally corresponds with this information.
Interesting. No, I mean, I think you are raising a great issue that actually motivation, the policy for motivation itself has to optimize their future reward. That's true.
And you could have good motivational states or sequences and useless ones.
Yes.
So, sort of in that same line, here the agent doesn't exactly control their motivation. Their motivation changes as a consequence of their actions on the state.
Mm-hmm.
But in the hierarchical version, it looked like there might have been some analog of action that actually affects the motivation itself. How do you think about that?
Yes, that's exactly how I think about it. So there's another network, that like the top level network, that changes motivation for the low level.
So like, can you give an example of that?
Yes, I think I did. What's wrong with this math example? So you change the top level manager will change Q function for, once it decides that it has to use Fourier transform, it will pass along this information to the lower level equation solver that will use a Q function that corresponds to this guy, that will use the Q function that basically, as an input, it's controlled by, it will basically implement the Fourier transform solution of it. Just a toolbox.
So in the case where you take an action, it changes your transitions between states.
Yes.
So here I'm trying to see how, like, okay, I'm deciding I'm using the Fourier transform. Maybe if you're going to do Fourier transform rather than Laplace transform, your transitions from blackboard to pen to solving in your head would be different, and maybe that would be more akin to what I'm used to thinking of in terms of action-dependent transitions between states. So here you want action-dependent transitions between motivations.
Right, exactly, yeah. But the action is defined by the individual levels. So the way I'm thinking about it is the action here is really changing in the motivational state. So this action is distinct from this one.
Mm-hmm.
Like you basically make a decision. You look at the math equation and you decide that, well, probably it's better to use Fourier transform or some other method, you know, just based on some of your experience, right? So you don't really tell how, the top level manager doesn't tell the low level manager how to do it. It just describes the strategy. Anyway, that's how I think about it.
Well, it seemed to me that the motivation for motivational factors should be better considered in terms of a homeostatic regulation. Right? You want to talk about hunger or thirst. You know, it's some kind of physiological set point that you need to attend, rather than thinking about this kind of high level hierarchical organization, enforcement. I would rather think in terms of homeostatic regulation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can think about, I mean, I think the homeostatic is the one which is the easiest to study.
But your ideas are not limited to this case, I think, is your point.
Right, but you don't have to be exclusive to
it's
that.
It's the time scale that matters to you more, it seems, than the relationship between this variable, set of variables, and... I think the key point like temperature here, or hunger or thirst.
Is there, if there are indeed like anatomically separated networks, so is there a network that will, I mean, are the different time scales, are they somehow, can they be mapped onto some form of anatomy? So there is a, so there is one network that, if time scales are all similar, that you can imagine that everything is mashed together and there's no strategy and tactics, right? So there is like one big network and everything is solved in one recurrent net, right? But if the time scales are different, then you may see a separation, like on the level of function or anatomy, where there is one network that controls the strategy and then there is another network that controls the tactics. You know, so therefore, like, I understand, I agree with you, with your point that...
Well, I'm just trying to understand your point, right?
That mathematically it's difficult to define. The question is if it's possible to define it, like, biologically, you know.
So it seems like, so here you have motivation as a latent variable. We don't get to directly observe it.
Yes.
Another way of thinking of the latent variable is that Q itself is latent, right? And that you have a different reward function at each moment in time. But the advantage of the motivational approach is that you now reduce the space of possible Q functions parameterized by, like, let's say a one-dimensional quantity, how hungry you are.
Yes.
So it's like a regularizer on how you might choose policies.
Yes. It basically removes a lot of policies, which are...
hierarchical.
Yeah.
Even without the hierarchy.
I mean, obviously, hierarchy, imposing hierarchy on the network...
You already put structure on the change of Q.
Like, obviously, imposing hierarchy is a restriction on the network, right?
Yeah. And smoothness. I mean, if you have categorical things like Fourier transform or not, then you don't get that regularity. But if you have something continuous, like how hungry am I, then that imposes a stronger regularization on the value.
Probably.
I have a much more naive question. You raise these motivations like hunger and thirst, so something physiological where it's clear what it is. But beyond this, what are the real life examples of motivations that you are thinking about? Right?
Desire for success. Desire for success. Right? Is that
not physiological?
A specific thing then? Because what's
I'm making it up. He should speak, but I think desires are some kind of abstract.
I mean, it's a tool. The way I think about it is a toolbox, right? So, you like if it's not physiological, it would be just a certain toolbox that you will be using, which doesn't prescribe you what exactly the tools to use. It just tells you what methods to use in this particular situation. So that's one example which is closest to me, which is like a math example. You can imagine that you can come up with a lot of examples. It's a social life. Where you use different...
I just don't understand this example. I don't see where motivation is. What's the motivation? Just to solve a problem?
No, it's to solve the problem. Use a particular set of methods to solve the problem.
So you have a summary of changing your policy.
So you have a math problem which you can solve with five different methods,
right?
Assuming, right? And then you look at them, and because of your training, you know which ones are more likely to succeed. So you have a two function, and which method you are going to use is your motivation, right?
And why do you call it motivation?
Because it's not a state. It's not an action or a state. Right, it determines like the set of possible actions that you can take. I mean, you disagree with me, obviously.
No, I'm not. I just don't understand what you're saying.
What don't you understand?
I don't say why I use the word motivation.
That's what we interpret in external states. And I think that you change which actions you choose based on your internal states. And that description is what you're calling motivation.
Is there any use to separate internal and external? What is the advantage gained through this separation?
I'm not so sure that example really is the best one about if you want to talk about motivation, because you know, some kind of higher level stuff, right? Is, you know, you always have to organize your behavior or solve a problem hierarchically, right? You have to decompose the problem into steps and all that. And that seemed to me kind of more cognitive kind of stuff, right? There are rules that you have to follow, right? You have to solve a sub-problem and then solve the whole problem. So, you know, there are people like Etienne Cochin who talk about organization of problem solving that involves different projects. So that seemed to be a somewhat different type of issues from motivation itself. Unless you just want to talk about hierarchical or reinforcement learning in general. Maybe that's what you're getting at. You know. Then,
I mean, I guess like
more than just motivation, right? Or justice. It can involve different types of hierarchical problem solving.
I mean, I guess I'm talking about the way how hierarchical problem solving can be implemented, you know, via, I mean, I call it motivation. I mean, it's a semantics, right? But there is something called motivational salience in psychology, which I think fits the bill. Just, of course, I'm generalizing, so I'm going from something which has, you know, component of, like, rewarded, unrewarded, like direct connection to physiology, something which is more abstract, and that
so mostly that come from lower level, you know, things like hunger and thirst, or do you also talk about more abstract cognitive problem solving?
No, I'm talking about problem solving. They talk about more down to earth rewards.
So you said that the model of this ventral pallidum data, that it didn't fit as well when you had the weak rewards, so the partial.
When I had to generalize.
Yes.
When I trained it, like, basically I chose the trials. I chose a subset of trials, but they included all sorts of conditions, like mixture of conditions. Then the model was very predictive. But when I chose a condition which was not included in the original set, when it had to basically generalize to the new condition, I was assuming that it would work better. I mean, it works with some correlation coefficient, 0.35. That's not as satisfactory.
But when you look at the output of these nuclei for hunger, thirst, and fear and things, is it kind of either you're fearful or you're hungry or you're not? If you measure, I don't know, the CFOS, or there's some measurement to say whether it's on or off. Is that how we classify them?
I think they're more continuous then.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the general rule is that, I mean, there are maybe about 20 nuclei in basal ganglia, and they all basically report the same. So the firing rate of those neurons is very redundant. And they, many of them go to dopaminergic neurons, they project to dopaminergic neurons, and they compute some kind of superposition, they compute a mixture. So it's really difficult to classify which area responds to hunger. Or it appears that there is an enormous amount of redundancy in the presentation of reward or punishment or hunger, you know, with slight biases such as VP, for example, is more involved in maintaining. It has very strong component in reward prediction as opposed to just CS or US or reward prediction error. So it does indeed have this delayed activity during the gap between CS and PS. So that's one thing which is kind of special about VP.
Right, I think we need to get the focus from the quantum theorists.